Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Bay Area's growing population and the booming tech sector has strained our roads and transit systems. Traffic in the Bay Area has gone from very bad to worse. Over the next 25 years, a projected 2 million new residents will live in the Bay Area, bringing the total population to more than 9 million people. So if you drive or take public transportation, you have seen these changes. Here's what the data tells us. The Bay Area freeway commute is moving at its slowest pace in over a decade. The number of people on the road between 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the morning is on the rise. This is according to the Metropolitan Transit Commission. Traffic on the Bay Bridge is the highest it's ever been. The MTC says because of so many new tech jobs in San Francisco, parking spots are becoming harder to find, and that's why people are leaving earlier. And then congestion out of San Francisco used to start at around 3 o'clock, and now it starts at 1:30. And then when it comes to public transportation, buses and trains are packed. But there has been a 14% decline in per capita transit ridership. So what explains that? Still, a recent poll conducted for the Bay Area Council finds that commuters support a $3 billion bond measure to improve BART and build a second Transbay tube connecting San Francisco and Oakland. So who's taking these issues seriously, and what solutions would you add to the mix? Today we're joined by Bob Allen, Urban Habitat's Director of Policy and Advocacy Campaigns. Bob has led the Transportation Justice Program at Urban Habitat since 2007. He also led the successful Free Muni for Youth campaign and Regional Equity campaign through the Six Wins for Social Equity Network. And Bob joins me in studio. Hi, Bob. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
We're also joined by Aegon Terplin, Regional Planning Director for SPUR, an urban policy think tank based in the Bay Area's central cities, San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose. Aegon has authored and co-authored a number of reports on regional planning and transportation, and he joins us on the line from SPUR's office in San Francisco. Hi, Aegon. Welcome back to the show.
Welcome. Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Nice to have you. And David Zisser is Public Advocate's staff attorney. David advocates for planning and development that puts low-income people first through community benefits, affordable housing, and transit. And David joins us on the line from Public Advocate's office in Oakland. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Glad to be with you.
Great to have you. So Bay Area traffic is getting really bad. It's the third worst in the country behind Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. Bob Allen, let's start off with you. What are the main factors causing conditions to get so bad?
Thanks, Rose. I think we should start with asking the question, how do we get here in terms of the patterns of housing, sprawl, segregation? We would look to decades of exclusionary housing policies and you know, many of the public investments that created suburbs and, quite frankly, the segregation that's happened in metropolitan regions like the Bay Area. So I think it's really important that we start with how cities and suburbs were created, especially with post-World War II investment. And again, I think housing is a real key link to that. So, you know, we're facing a situation now that's been conditioned, like I said, by decades of these policies. And from the transportation side, often we're trying to fix problems that are really housing problems, mm-hmm. land use problems. So I think we should start with that framework and understood that we got ourselves into this position, you know, often through publicly subsidizing these bad patterns of growth where people live where they can't live. So if we're going to fix it, I think we need to start with that understanding and move to address those conditions that are still very present in the Bay Area.
And do you feel like public officials are framing it that way? Are they admitting this?
At least in my experience dealing with public agencies like the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, I think there's still an elected officials who represent their local jurisdictions on these regional bodies. There isn't a sense that, you know, the peninsula's resistance to build real affordable housing or to protect against displacement of low-income black and brown residents contributes directly to the housing and transportation problems in the Bay Area. They want to look to San Francisco and say, it's a problem of tech, it's a problem of you in San Francisco not having good housing policies. And in reality, these are really regional problems. Mm-hmm. And one community's decision to segregate and not allow people to live there puts greater burdens on the transportation system, increases traffic on 101. So we can't solve it just in one community.
Right. And we'll talk about this later because I think that's really important. People who are poor or low income who are being displaced are moving further out of the cities, and yet in many cases still work in the cities.
And those are the folks who rely most on public transit,
right,
as opposed to choice riders who, you know, for lifestyle reasons may or may not take transit. I think we can't leave those people behind for, you know, moral and political reasons, but also we're going to undermine how transit gets used.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about that. Egon, what are your thoughts on how we got here?
Well, I think if the here we're talking about is a region that has significant traffic, as you framed it before, I mean, Bob's right. This is at its root a land use issue, that the Bay Area in its formation was a pretty small, narrow place with dense areas, walkable areas built around transit going back many years. San Francisco, Oakland, the inner ring of the Bay Area there, and a small series of communities down the peninsula were all linked by rail. We grew very quickly in the post-war years, largely on an auto-oriented format. So many of our jobs are in places that the easiest way to get there is to drive. And so when we have economic booms and there's lots of job growth and there's lots of commuters trying to get to and from their jobs, mostly they're going to be out on the roads. And so that is, and then the housing side of it, they're not living close by. Some are, but even if they're living close by, they're still often on the roads. So fundamentally, when you build a region that's not mostly built around our transit infrastructure, that's the situation we get into. And so it took a long while to get out of there, but I think there's actually some promising directions we're going in, which I think we should get to about how some of this is changing. But at the bare minimum, our region kind of continued to grow outward, and the point we're at now is there are people making very long commutes across an infrastructure, a highway infrastructure, which frankly we have for policy reasons decided not to significantly expand for many years. So we're using a highway infrastructure that we built a long time ago and a transit infrastructure that we also built a long time ago.
And what are those policy reasons?
Well, I think, I mean, there's been a shift in our region. For many years, we continued to build highways out at the edge. We continue to expand them. And we're still doing that now. There certainly are still highway lanes being added. But there's really been a shift in the funding to say we're going to put most of the money into the maintenance of our existing system, not to the expansion of our system. And so that means the money goes back into BART, the money goes back into the existing highways, and less of the money is spent on expansion. There still is expansion, and we can talk about what some of that means, and there's major questions about where BART lines might be extended beyond the current boundaries, but that, at least on the transportation side. I would just say big picture, though, that's transportation. The big, big challenge in the Bay Area is the land use decisions, how much housing, what kind of housing, where jobs are located. Those are all made locally, mm-hmm. And there's over 100 local governments in the Bay Area making those decisions, and they're making those decisions from the perspective about what's best for their community, not what's best for the entire region. So fundamentally, we have a disconnect there, and that's really the kind of core governance challenge that we're facing.
And what would it take to really deal with that disconnect?
Well, part of it is I think communities need to start making decisions with the broader region, the interests of the broader region, not just with the interests of their specific communities. And some of that is leadership, some of that's perspective, some of that is perhaps related to funding. If you're going to be not approving housing around your transit system or approving tremendous amount of job growth that's not accessible by transit, there's an argument to be made that maybe the region shouldn't be investing scarce infrastructure money in some of your local streets and roads. So you can tie some of the regional funding to local implementation of policies that support a regional vision. It's not forcing them to change their local land use. It's simply saying, why should the region be investing money in a place that's not growing in a way that meets a broader set of regional goals?
And David, you advocate for planning and development that puts low-income people first through affordable housing and transit. What concerns the people that you work with most when we're talking about all of these transportation issues?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, the things that concern low-income communities of color the most is also part of the answer to how we got here. We are not investing in the kind of transit that actually serves the needs of low-income people and low-income communities of color, particularly local bus service. We're not creating and preserving affordable housing near jobs and transit. And as Egon said, there are things that the region can do to encourage cities to build and preserve their fair share of affordable housing so that people are not commuting long distances in their cars and congesting the roads. We do not have enough anti-displacement protections in place to ensure that low-income people can remain in their homes and their communities as those communities face increasing gentrification pressures. And we're not asking low-income communities what they need. Folks who live in these communities know best what they need. They have the wisdom to also think about solutions to the problems they're facing. And the things that they need are affordable housing, expanded bus service, and the assurance that they can stay in their communities and be a part of the growth that is happening in these communities.
So why don't we talk about solutions before we dive in and spend more time about how we got here and how bad things are, because we know things are really bad. So what's at the top of your list, Bob? I mean, what changes would you like to see?
So I think there needs to be a fundamental start of reframing when we talk about expanding transit service. And, you know, part of the conversation today is how to increase access to high-quality public transportation. And I think one of the challenges over decades has been that when political officials look at improving transit, they often looked at shiny new projects where they can go out, take a picture with a gold shovel. And infrastructure is a very important part of the equation. But I think we've showed that for the region and for, even at the local context, that when you invest increasing the current capacity of the system we have, ridership now, so that, you make a bus more frequent from 15 to 10 minutes. You increase the footprint of what we have right now, and you change that conversation. That's the prerequisite. That has to be the first thing we do, both politically, because these are folks who've been relying on transit for years, and they deserve to not have to wait until new people move into their communities so they get better transit service.
So improve the public transit system, for example, that we have now.
And be very strategic about when we do expansions, like Aga mentioned, whether it's BART extensions, some of the airport connector projects that we've been very much at the center of fighting because we think they're not the best use of investments. Look, I wish we were not doing a lot of things in California. I wish we weren't spending this much money on a prison industrial complex, lots of other bad investments nationally, and, we could get into that. But the reality is we're not, and we need to first make the system we have work for the people who are riding it and using it. That will also build confidence, and that will show people I can give up my car and actually have a reliable alternative.
Right. So what are the barriers to doing that? This seems like a very simple solution.
One of the barriers, and we probably don't want to go down this road too deeply, but there is a fundamental kind of divide in how we raise transit revenue and what it can be used for. And actually raising money to operate more transit service is actually a very difficult problem. It involves federal policy, which is skewed towards highways and capital construction. Supervisor Wieners talked about this subway master plan. The feds will kick in, decent amounts of resources for transit expansion, but they don't provide operating money to run transit service. We've got the new greenhouse gas reduction dollars coming from the cap and trade program. That provides potential for new revenue. So it's been a revenue problem in terms of raising revenue. In Santa Clara, Contra Costa, and San Francisco over the next year, there are significant transportation sales tax measures being explored. And I think that's a key opportunity to get that local revenue to prioritize local service.
Bob Allen is Urban Habitat's Director of Policy and Advocacy Campaigns. He worked on the successful Free Muni for Youth campaign. Egon Terplin is Regional Planning Director for SPUR, and David Zisser is Staff Attorney with Public Advocates. Today, we are talking about our roads and highways. We've all experienced worse traffic in the past couple of years. The commute on the freeway is moving at its slowest pace in over a decade. More people are on the roads between 4 and 5 in the morning. According to the MTC, it's because people are looking for parking spots in San Francisco. They're really hard to find. Traffic on the Bay Bridge is the highest it's ever been. So today we are talking about solutions. What can be done about this? What has your experience been like on the road? What's really changed? And what solutions would you like to see? Are your city officials taking this issue seriously? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you drive, Would you be willing to drive less if public transportation improved? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's stick with public transportation for a while. And Aegon, I was surprised to read that public transit ridership has increased over the past two decades by about 3%. But during that same time, there's been a 14% decline in per capita transit ridership. This is according to the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Why is that? What explains this?
Alicia, you look back even to 1991, and total transit ridership in the Bay Area is pretty flat. So I'd say there's a couple of things, and this is where it's really important. Let's think about the land use reasons why people take or don't take transit, and then let's think about the transportation. You know, what about transit that isn't working as well as it should? So first of all, on the land use side, this is back to what I was saying before. Jobs continue to spread out and often go to places that are not served by transit. So it's not a surprise that people aren't taking transit. People take transit by and large in the Bay Area to go to and from work in downtown San Francisco, in downtown Oakland, in downtown Berkeley, in Palo Alto, and a smattering of other places. But outside of that, to work commutes, which when we're thinking about peak capacity on the highways, that's really the work commuting we're talking about, transit ridership to work is very low on a regional scale. Now, there are people who don't have automobiles and low-income populations who rely on transit, but as a percent of the overall population, most people are overall driving. It's a couple of places that are different. So as jobs spread out in more places, fewer people take transit. Now, then just the other side of that is what's been happening on the transit side. So the big, big challenge is that the bus systems we have in the region are often stuck in traffic. And so if you're going to get on a bus and it's not time competitive with driving, you're often not going to stay on that bus. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of bus systems have not been able to keep up speed, and actually average speeds are declining. Why is that happening? It's happening because often local cities aren't willing to take the political risk or even just the vision to say, let me give the bus its own lane. And you've seen these fights related to bus rapid transit in the peninsula, in the South Bay, even in San Francisco, conversations around kind of dedicated lanes. That's the critical thing you can do to bus service. You can put as much service, you know, add new service as Bob is talking about, it's fine, but if the bus is stuck in traffic, it's not going to be desirable for a lot of people, particularly low-income riders that have to get to work at a certain time. So that's what's happened on the bus system. But then rail, Caltrain and BART, they're exploding in ridership precisely because they are so competitive with driving. The Bay Bridge corridor is unpredictable. Now, it's increasingly unpredictable on BART, which we should get to, but the Bay Bridge is really full. And then Caltrain is booming in ridership because some people don't want to sit in their cars on the 101 and 280 corridors. So that's a real, and I think that's a fundamentally important factor that affects. If you can take transit, if you're near transit from your origin, from where you're leaving from your home, and if your job or your destination is close to transit at the end, and then that transit trip is not stuck in traffic, you're much, much more likely to take it.
We have a number of comments online. I posted this on my Facebook page and got at least 25 comments from people in the Bay Area. Barbara writes, people are not going to get rid of their cars or lower their car usage unless and until there is better public transit, and I don't mean bikes. She says, I hate to drive. I don't even own a car. I love mass transit. The mass transit in the Bay Area is an embarrassment and a disgrace. And Harry says, why do fees keep going up? Why is there a $5 surcharge on BART to the airport? Why are BART fares so high, which make people want to drive? David, would you take those two comments?
Well, I think those are some valid concerns, and I think the transit system itself is one of the challenges. I think, and Aegon alluded to this, that another challenge is what we call the jobs-housing imbalance. In places where there are jobs, there's not enough housing at all income levels for people to actually get to their jobs easily, and people aren't living near transit either. In Santa Clara and San Mateo counties, for instance, 70,000 low-wage workers commute more than 50 miles to their jobs.
70,000?
That's bad for the environment, and, of course, it's hard on workers and their families. Suburban job centers have severe housing shortages, and it's because those suburbs, in many cases, are not producing the amount of affordable housing in the places they need to produce it, and places near transit and jobs also often do not have the adequate protections that people need to keep them in their homes and their communities. In addition, the regional planning process focuses 80% of the growth in what are called priority development areas, which are predominantly low-income communities of color in sort of the urban core. 69% of low-income households live in those areas, and 69% of those low-income households are at risk of displacement. The more people that are forced to move further away, the more people are going to be required to get in their cars and commute because of the challenges around public transit and the cost of it as well. It costs a lot to commute from the fringes of the Bay Area into the San Francisco and Oakland and Palo Alto job centers. And that's just exacerbating the public transit challenges as well.
Bob?
Yeah, and I think it's really important to bring in the issue of the kind of public and private provision of transit, especially being in the Bay Area where we see Uber and Lyft. You know, I think our opinion, and I think if we could ever get a hold of some of the data, they'd like to share it, is that they're putting a lot more cars on the road. That's, you know, impacting walking, biking, and taking public transportation. We know about the shuttle issue, which is out there right now. And the flip side of that is the folks who are displaced, as David said, to communities that have less public transit access. We don't have creative solutions out there to get them transit in the near term. And we're in the Bay Area. We ought to be able to figure out ways to have, you know, on-demand public shuttle options, van pools that meet those folks' needs. But we know that every tech job that's created in the city induces or creates 2 to 3 low-wage jobs. Those folks are going to be out in the periphery. They're going to be commuting back in without transit access. So we're just going to be exacerbating an already difficult situation.
We have a few questions about Uber, Lyft, and the private buses that shuttle people back and forth between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. Sue writes, 20,000 Uber cars in the Bay Area alone, and I looked this up. According to Uber's blog, they have 20,000 drivers in the Bay Area, but we don't know how many drivers are on the road at any given time. And Bob, is that because they won't release that data?
I've seen them on, you know, other Bay Area news programs, and they don't seem to be very willing to do that. And I haven't seen, and maybe other guests have, really strong efforts to try to, you know, work with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission or other public agencies to figure out in an effective way, you know, what this ride sharing means for our transportation system. My own view is, as someone who advocates with and for low-income communities and communities of color, is that, you know, that's not the solution, that there needs to be a public alternative. And we can't, you know, invest in policies that displace communities out to places where there's not public transportation and say your solution is a very, you know, tenuous relationship with ride sharing or, you know, Uber or Lyft. I think that's politically problematic. And it's going to put the burden on an already overburdened transportation system to get those folks back into to the cities where jobs are actually at.
We have another comment. Please talk about why there are so many unregulated, unsafe tour buses everywhere polluting the city, and why private, not public, taxis are allowed in the red Muni-only lanes on Market and Mission and other congested and limited access transportation corridors. Why are for-profit business cars that typically serve a single affluent customer allowed to get special privileges in Muni lanes? We'll talk about that after the break. On today's Your Call, we are talking about our roads, traffic, transportation. We've all experienced it. Traffic has gone from very bad to worse. So today we are talking about solutions and who's really taking these issues seriously. We'd love to hear from you. What's your experience been like on the roads? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
If you'd like to engage in this morning's conversation on Your Call, toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you'd prefer to write, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. At noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor in Philosophy Talk. This week, will innovation kill us?
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the attacks in Paris that killed more than 130 people and injured hundreds. The latest ISIS attacks have sparked fresh debates about how to defeat ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So what led to the creation of ISIS? How did we get here? And if the war on terror is creating even more terror, what are real alternatives? That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, we'd love to hear about your experiences on the road. If you drive, what has it been like? If public transportation were to improve, would you spend more time on BART, for example, or on buses? And what solutions would you like to see? Are your city officials talking about these issues and taking them seriously? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Bob Allen is Urban Habitat's Director of Policy and Advocacy Campaigns. Aegon Turplin is Regional Planning Director for SPUR, and David Zisser is Staff Attorney with Public Advocates. Aegon, what are your thoughts on the buses and Uber and Lyft and how they have contributed to traffic? I just got word that the Natural Resources Defense Council and UC Berkeley are going to team up for a year-long study of the environmental impacts of Uber and Lyft. They're going to take a look at, do these services really result in a drop in personal car ownership? Because that's what we often hear from the companies. But have any studies been done looking at how they're affecting the roads?
Yeah, I think this is where we have to start and say, let's think a little bit long term, and let's also think about the moment that we're in. We're in a moment of tremendous change and uncertainty. So there's a lot of tension around what's happening, is this best, what direction is it all going in. I think that if we look forward 20 years, there is going to be a significant amount of autonomous vehicles on the roads. Like, we haven't even talked about that issue, but that's something we need to acknowledge. And then you work back from that and then say, what's the system that we should have? And the real fundamental break that I think we're heading towards is the fact that a smaller number of people are going to need to own their own private vehicle. And so once we get our head around that, then we say, well, then how should people get around that don't have to have a private vehicle that they store at their home and at their work and at a parking place somewhere else in the middle of it? And then there's a lot of options. There's existing public transit. There's the emerging ride sharing. There's the shuttles that we've just touched on. And I think all of those are in play and all of those exist. I would say are the existing Uber and Lyft, are they contributing to more cars on the road? That's worth asking. That's worth studying. I would differ a little bit from Bob, though, from the perspective of, are these services ones that are not going to serve low-income customers? Let's flip that on its head for a moment and think about all the places in the Bay Area that are low-density, that do not have good public transit service, but could be served by some form of ride-sharing. And imagine if low-income residents in those places had access to a Clipper card that were subsidized that they could use to go on some of those ride-sharing programs, and they could get service within 5 minutes instead of a bus that comes every 40 minutes. And so part of it is just sort of adjusting our thinking around how we want to take the moment we're in and shape it in a direction that moves to the future. So, I don't think it's exactly clear where it's all going.
So I'm trying to visualize what you're saying. So basically, like, for example, if there's a ride share from San Leandro to San Francisco or Fremont to San Francisco, you envision a time when low-income riders can join that? Not a ride share, I guess Uber and Lyft. If Uber and Lyft are driving to San Francisco, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not talking about to San Francisco. This is where we have to distinguish between local and regional trips. From San Leandro to San Francisco or Fremont to San Francisco, the best way is probably going to be on BART and making sure that BART's, but maybe you live in a place that's 3 miles from the BART station, and the bus that would take you to that BART station runs every 40 minutes, and it's not coordinated with the BART train. Or what if you need to get to a doctor's appointment down the road and you live in Fremont or San Leandro or Hayward or some other community that doesn't have good bus service? Why couldn't there be a system where we have some kind of public subsidy to people that are using some of those systems?
Bob, what do you think?
Well, I would say, why couldn't there be a system that is, designed and, run by the public agencies that fills that gap as well? I mean, many of the places that organizations like SPUR look to around the world that have great public transit, at least when I read the reports by similar organizations, they don't tout them for their ride-sharing being the kind of key factor why they have great transit. I think it's a little bit problematic from our perspective to say that those communities are going to be equally served by a commercial operation like Uber or Lyft. Are those, you know, what happens when Uber or Lyft drivers say, I don't want to go into East Oakland. I don't want to go into Antioch. I don't want to go into that neighborhood. I mean, I think, look, they're going to exist and they're going to play a role in the transportation ecosystem. But the idea that the primary provision of public transit as a public good, especially for communities, and I think Egon's right, this is the lower density suburban communities. I would flip Egon's formulation on its head and say, why can't we, you know, work with the tech sector in the Bay Area to come up with solutions where we have on-demand shuttles, but again, that are reliable, that are going to serve all the communities and are not going to be left up to vagaries of whether the venture capitalists think that Uber is a good investment or a bad investment. I think it's a bad way to plan for the kind of growth in the future. Yes, they're going to play a role in the ecosystem. That should not be the primary way that we try to provide transit for people in these transit who are transit dependent in very transit poor communities.
David, what do you think? And then we'll get Egon to respond.
I guess I'd sort of question part of the premise. I mean, I think we have to ask why people are forced to live in places where they don't have adequate access to transit, whether that's, you know, buses that can get them to key BART stations or directly to their jobs, or ensuring that folks have housing that they can afford near existing transit hubs. And there are solutions now. It is important, I think, to think about the future and what technology can mean for transportation, but the regional agencies in charge of planning for transportation are making decisions this week and in the coming months about how to spend hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars, in transportation funds. And Egon was talking about this before. They can use some of that money to encourage local jurisdictions, cities, and including the suburbs, to produce more affordable housing near transit and jobs, to adopt policies that prevent people from being forced to live in these inaccessible places. They can make decisions about investing more of those transportation dollars in expanding bus service and transit service and reducing fares so that people can afford to get to their jobs and to the places where they need to go. They can begin to ask local communities what exactly they need. And I just want to add briefly, 2 years ago, the regional agencies noted that a particular scenario for the regional plan called Plan Bay Area, this scenario was developed by communities that put the needs of low-income communities and communities of color first. The regional agencies determined that that was the environmentally superior scenario. It not only produced better results for people with low income, it actually produced better results for public health and for the environment, and those are things that benefit the entire region. So when we start to think about transportation planning and land use planning from the perspective of people who actually rely on transit and who have the greatest needs, we actually get better outcomes for everybody. And the regional agencies have the opportunity to do that right now.
Egon, quick response, and then I'll get to emails. We have a ton of emails and phone calls.
Just very quickly, I think in terms of transit, we have to think about it. Jarrett Walker writes about this really well, and he talks about a debate, ridership or coverage. If we want high ridership on our transit systems, the way we get high ridership is putting high-frequency service on trunk lines where people can go and they don't have to plan for it. Places like Geary Boulevard, El Camino Real, San Pablo in the East Bay, International Boulevard, making these core trunk lines really, really reliable. We can run tons of buses to all the low-density parts of the Bay Area all the time and spend the money. That could be a public policy choice to make, but I think the question is that going to be the best use of our resources? And if we're talking about low-income residents, do we want frequent service or do we want service that covers a lot of places? We're probably not going to do both, and I think that's part of the reality check we need to get to. So I would argue that we need to have great, robust transit systems all throughout our Bay Area. We invest a lot in it. The piece that we don't do well enough is to have really reliable service on these core routes that connect to the centers of many, many of our communities. And that's what we might call trunk lines.
And the question is why? We have an email from Howard who says, a good public transportation system could take cars off our roads. Unfortunately, public transportation sucks here. We just returned from a visit to Europe where it's modern, clean, quiet, runs frequently, and goes where people need to go. Public transportation is woefully underfunded in the United States. What we have that Europeans don't is a $630 billion budget for war toys. Well, a military budget just passed the Senate 91 to 3 last Tuesday, $600 billion. Is it funding, Bob? Is that the main issue?
I mean, I won't put people through the pain of what's been going on with the federal transportation reauthorization, which is the federal bill. 80% goes to highways nationally, 20% goes to transportation. Almost all the transit funding is for, again, for capital maintenance and construction. So, yeah, we have a huge problem at the federal level. There's no doubt about that. I think the coverage versus concentration argument that Aegon puts out there is a reality in terms of planning, but it's a reality because of our funding priorities being really skewed. And just to clarify, I think the challenge I was putting out is a challenge to all the tech community out there and those who even listen to this program. You know, instead of talking about being disruptive, I'd like to see them being constructive. I'd like to see them step up and offer solutions. Like I said, in low-density communities where we don't have the resources or the political will to run bus service, or maybe it's not practical, and that's not what we're saying. But as far as the kind of footprint that tech has on the city of San Francisco and the region, I'd love to see them helping to design, fund, and support, primarily through paying the taxes they should pay, but in other ways, to create a, you know, the equivalent of a public sector Google bus. Let's have some pilot programs that looked at all workers. We did an analysis as part of a grant through Housing and Urban Development Department last year of low-wage workers in the growth industries, we'll say, in Santa Clara. And most of them are living in very rent-burdened conditions, overcrowded conditions, so they can live closer to work because they can't take transit and they can't take the Google bus. In fact, a lot of these workers can't use the bike share on tech campuses. So there is a real divide that's put up. And I would describe it as the gentrification of transit itself in the Bay Area. So my challenge is, like I said, be constructive. Don't just talk about being disruptive and help us build solutions that can meet the needs of riders, as Aegon said, where we're not going to be able to run that kind of bus service tomorrow. I'd love to see that.
Bob Allen is Urban Habitat's Director of Policy and Advocacy Campaigns. He worked on the successful Free Muni for Youth campaign. Aegon Terplin is Regional Planning Director with SPUR, and David Zissler is Staff Attorney with Public Advocates. David, what are your thoughts on that email I just read about funding? We have another one from Marcy that says, can you talk about the government bodies that make transportation funding decisions locally and regionally? Also, some of the obstacles of low-income communities and communities of color being heard in this process, and can you talk about the organizing to meet these challenges?
Yeah. You mentioned the six wins for Social Equity Network. Both Urban Habitat and Public Advocates are members of this regional coalition of 20-something community organizations throughout the Bay Area. We and these other organizations in the six wins have identified that, again, when you build in to regional planning the needs of low-income people, you get better outcomes for everybody. And that's, thinking, again, about affordable housing, about preventing displacement, about how we invest in transit that serves low-income community needs, about public health, and about community voice. And there's a lot of work being done at the regional level, and I do want to acknowledge that the regional agencies, the MTC and ABAG, kind of an alphabet soup, have really started to acknowledge the growing problem of housing affordability and displacement. And there's an acknowledgement in the region and in the state that when you displace low-income residents and when you have trouble housing low-income residents near jobs and transit, you have worse results for transit ridership. People who are low income who live near transit are more likely to use transit than others who live near transit. So keeping them near public transit is actually good for the environment and good for transit ridership. There's a lot, as we said, a lot of solutions already exist, and I'll just give one example. For instance, out of 109 jurisdictions in the region, only 6 cities have both rent stabilization and just cause eviction protections, which many of us consider to be the strongest protections against displacement. The region has a role in both integrating its transportation planning and its land use planning, or its housing. And as both Egon and I have said, the region can take steps to encourage cities to adopt stronger policies that keep people in their homes closer to transit and closer to their jobs. And again, MTC will actually be making a decision tomorrow about how to spend some of those funds that can be used to encourage cities to do that.
I mentioned the recent poll from MTC, or study, looking at transit ridership actually going down. It's about a 14% decline in per capita ridership over the past 2 decades. And the Bay Area Council just did a poll and found that commuters support a $3 billion bond measure to improve BART and build a second Transbay tube connecting San Francisco and Oakland. And Rolf writes, "I often use BART to travel between San Francisco and Oakland and notice long delays just across the bay. Can you say something about whether BART's Transbay tube will ever be expanded?" Who wants to take that one?
I'll jump into that. I mean, so let's think about the tube that connects Oakland and San Francisco. So that was built in the 1970s. The Bay Bridge was built in the 1930s. It was rebuilt over the past 20 years, but there's been no new capacity between this critical part of our region in decades. So if we're adding 2 million people, and frankly, if you look at transit ridership in the region, a large portion of the transit ridership is between Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco and back and forth between those areas. This is sort of the critical regional connectivity from a transit perspective just because of the densities of the communities and the historical patterns. So do we need a second rail crossing? We definitely do. Does it have to be BART? Not necessarily. And I think this is an important issue to look at. We have Caltrain extends from San Francisco south to San Jose. In addition to BART, we also have the Capital Corridor, which is an Amtrak line from San Jose up through the East Bay all the way to Sacramento. And Oakland is now really starting to think about how could Oakland benefit from a second rail crossing between San Francisco and Oakland. And there's some thought that it could be BART plus conventional rail. BART is not like any other rail system. It's wider. It's unique. And imagine if you could have Caltrain that could come across the bay and connect in with a Capital Corridor, and you could ride a train and really connect to many more communities. So we're at a very important moment in thinking about that. It's going to be extremely expensive to do that. But if you look at what happened just this morning, BART had huge delays. There was a fire that affected the freeway network, and then the system breaks down. It doesn't have there's no backup. And increasingly now, as we've talked in this conversation with some low-income residents and workers moving to different parts of the region for affordability reasons, they still have to get back to jobs. And if you're getting off if you work at a restaurant, you're getting off in the late at night. You're a baker coming to job in the morning. Having a 24-hour system is actually only possible if you have a second rail crossing. You could run buses, of course, all night long on the Bay Bridge, but it doesn't connect out to as many communities.
Well, and to that point, Paul writes, a lot of people cannot take BART because it closes at midnight, so why not put up a ballot initiative? He says he has the domain BART247.com. BART would only need to run one line at night so they can work on one of the lines. They could have a night train and run once an hour. Roads are subsidized and are free. BART needs to be cheaper, not free, but a lot cheaper. The bridge toll should fund the Transbay tube. Do you think that BART will ever extend its hours, Bob?
Yeah, I think this really brings to kind of sharp relief, and Egon referred to this earlier. We have to get our priorities, I think, straight too, and that really involves making sure that the current system is maintained and runs properly. And that's the first step in, I think, having a system that people actually will rely on and can have confidence in. So I would say this. I would say part of the problem is we have, for the merits or drawbacks, we have an elected board for the BART board. And that means people want, because they feel like their districts have been paying into the BART system, they want extensions often. And that's a huge tension. So the governance of BART, and to be honest, the governance of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, where you have local elected officials who have no political incentive to act in the regional interest. They have a disincentive. Their only incentive is to bring projects, to bring money into their local jurisdiction. Now, I don't know today whether, having an elected regional governance agency is the best way to go, because we still have local land use control. But I guess what I'm saying is there is a problem with the kind of institutions we have. There's an institutional mismatch that's set up. And, you know, when we get to issues like, should we have a second tube? I wish, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when we were fighting about whether we should build a 3-mile Oakland Airport connector for $500 million, we really thought about that and said, well, you know, we could do a bus rapid transit alternative that could be a major improvement for $60 million. And it's not that simple because the funding, again, as we talked about, is often restricted. But that's the kind of choices we have to really be thinking about and how we plan for transit and the kind of investments we make. And we haven't been doing that up to this point. And I think we're going to go to the voters. They need to see, especially low-income voters, voters of color, mm-hmm. in San Francisco and other counties, they're going to want to see improvements that meet their current needs as well.
Is there any way to change what you just described?
I mean, right now there's a conversation, depending upon your perspective, of whether there should be a quote-unquote merger between the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is called MTC, or the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and our Association of Bay Area Governments. And there's a proposed, you know, process that's going to be launched. If folks want to get involved in the new year, you know, you can, you know, visit some of our websites or go to the MTC and learn a little bit more about that for a proposed merger. We hope that that'll be a real discussion about things like the fact that Napa County gets one vote and San Francisco gets two votes on the MTC. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem to represent the Bay Area demographics or the kind of structural arrangements in the Bay Area and the forces kind of driving some of the questions we're doing with. So we think there needs to be a deep conversation about what we can do with regional governance.
We have time to hear from one more listener. Let's go to Gabriel in San Francisco. Hi, Gabriel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Gabriel.
Oh, Gabriel, sorry.
It's all right. I live in San Francisco in the Northeast Mission. I was part of a local group that talked a lot about these issues because we had issues here in our neighborhood. One thing is that the idea that we're never going to get rid of, we can just get rid of cards one day, it seems really hard to digest because there's always people with needs, such as school teachers who carry their materials back and forth from schools, or construction workers who build things. They have their tools they need to carry. How are they going to get rid of their cars? And, of course, these are people that we're trying to provide services for us all over the Bay Area. Another thing is that we need to be looking at lots of different models that do work. You know, a generalization that we are one of the richest countries in the world, and there's Brazil, and there's some city there I haven't looked at in a long time, but they managed to provide free transportation for their city. How do they do that? Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at all these models that exist that are working, and it's just been touched upon already. We've talked a long time about integrating all the local public systems, transportation systems we have in the Bay Area, which, of course, is a huge task, but that might bring down costs for our transportation riders.
Well, thank you for calling in. Bob, quick comment?
I think one of the great things was the proof of what happens when you organize communities around a campaign like the Free Muni for Youth program. You know, a very small investment of around $3 million a year to provide free public transit for up to 40,000 youth in the city. We don't have neighborhood schools. And that's the kind of investment that you start to build not just the next generation of transit riders, but you start to build, you know, kind of a collective sense of public ownership in transit. And then when we go back to the voters for massive increases in transit funding, you know, those communities that rely on transit the most can see they're going to get some benefits. So I think, you know, we think, and the California state plan for Caltrans for the next 25 years or 20 years or so is, you know, talks about doubling walking and biking, making transit free. So this is a vision that's set out from the level of the governor and the state house.
Making transit free.
As a big part of, you know, inducing ridership and building kind of a long-term commitment to transit.
And Aegon, your final thoughts. Bob told us what changes he would like to see. What about you? What's at the top of your list?
Let me just throw three things out there. One of them is we haven't touched in this conversation on pricing driving at all. And so if we want to make transit more affordable, if we want to expand it, one of the things we should look at is managing the demand on our highway and road system and maybe having tolls in places that haven't had tolls. That's something you see in other parts of the world, and it's certainly a source and to look at. We're not allowed to, for example, put a toll on 101 somewhere between San Francisco and San Jose, but that's a way that you could really generate revenue and look at that. Two, we actually do need to make investments in our existing transit system. Think of Caltrain. Ridership is booming, but it's infrequent. Hour service in the middle of the day. We're trying to electrify it. Imagine if Caltrain were running at 15-minute headways, you know, running every 15 minutes up and down the corridor. Really, you could transform people's travel patterns throughout the behavior. throughout the Bay Area. And third, if you look at BART stations and Caltrain stations in so many places in the Bay Area, you see vacant lots, very, very low-density development. And again, if we're going to want to shift people's travel patterns, we have to make sure that there's more stuff, there's more destinations, there's more homes around our existing transit system. And we've just done a study on downtown Oakland that we're working in now. There's 40 acres of vacant lots and parking lots just in downtown Oakland where there's 3 BART stations. And more BART service than anywhere else in the Bay Area. Every train in the BART system goes through downtown Oakland, not downtown San Francisco. So we have underused the places around our transit system, and I think that's a big opportunity going forward.
And David, brief final thoughts, about 30 seconds.
Sure. You know, when we talk about both regional investments and county measures like sales tax measures to fund transportation, two things. Need to continue to make sure that transit works for those who need it, that, you know, the buses and trains are running frequently, that they're going to the places where people live, that they're affordable, that they're operating at hours when people actually work. And second, that people can continue to afford to live in inclusive communities that are, as a result, healthier, more equitable, and closer to transit.
Well, speaking of affordability, if you missed yesterday's show, we talked about how Bay Area renters can protect themselves from evictions and high rent increases. Check that out at yourcallradio.org. David Visser is staff attorney with Public Advocates. Aegon Turplin is regional planning director with SPUR. And Bob Allen is director of policy and advocacy campaigns with Urban Habitat. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you very
much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the coordinated terrorist attacks in Paris that killed more than 130 people and injured hundreds. The latest attacks have sparked fresh debates about how to defeat ISIS in Iraq and Syria. France has escalated its bombings of ISIS positions in Syria. So what led to the creation of ISIS? How did we get here? And if the war on terror is creating even more terror, what are real alternatives? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.